I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. I'm going to ask for a little indulgence today for a freewheeling conversation I had with author Joan Frank. She is the author of 12 books of fiction and nonfiction. Joan is such an observer of human wonder and circumstance that is lusciously relatable and rendered in living color. I have read most of her books, have interviewed her several times, and we enjoy talking with one another. And I'm in awe of her as a writer. That is my confession up front. I hope for you, Joan will open you up not only to her writing, but to the idea that it is through certain writers, and I include her in this group, that we learn to feel a sense of gratitude for language and expression, that we see ourselves, or sometimes parts of ourselves, that we can't quite or don't want to articulate, and that we do come out of the story told with a sigh or a tear or a chuckle, and we feel relieved that someone has told this story. Her candor always grabs me, and she writes about writing and the life of an artist. Before I bring you my most recent conversation with Joan, let's listen to her reading from her book of essays, Late Work, A Literary Autobiography of Love, Loss, and What I Was Reading. Here is Joan Frank.
Suzanne, would you like me to read about just a few paragraphs about the absurdity of persisting in making literary writing? It's from Late Work, and what's it called? I think it's from the piece called The New Doubt. It's called It Seemed Important at the Time, The New Doubt, and it talks about the literary writer doubting herself and then trying to come to terms with the unanswerable riddle of why do it? So here we go. What other pursuit regards itself and the human predicament so intradimensionally? So expansively, deeply, wryly. I'm hearing the words from Dover Beach, so various, so beautiful, so new. What other avocation musters such patient self-irony, while also acting out in raw, sweaty earnestness? What other gig lends perceived existence such shape-shifting pith and scope and momentum and even somehow wit? Above all, if you gave it up, what would be left? Mindful that what we make gets washed away, if we could devise a more gratifying preoccupation, would we not have long ago set off in a heartbeat to find it, whistling? This curious standoff might best be distilled in a scene from the 1966 art house film King of Hearts. In it, a young Scottish soldier, Alan Bates, arrives to a small French town that's been abandoned by its citizens after wartime fightings left it booby-trapped. Bates has been assigned to find a bomb set to go off there by the Germans. The town's insane asylum inmates, a ragtag lot, have escaped their confinement and wander the streets blissfully. Bates's soldier, figuring out when the bomb will blow, but unable to disarm it, strives without success to round up these hapless innocents and hustle them out of there. They don't understand. They find his urgency touching and go on about their dreamy business. One fellow, I seem to recall, likes to hold a velvet ribbon against his cheek. At last, Bates's frantic soldier accosts the luminously beautiful, mad young ballerina, Geneviève Boujold, grappling for words to make her realize they must flee at once. Destruction is imminent. They have, he shouts at her, only 6 minutes before the explosion. She searches his face with her enormous, lovely, dark eyes. 6 minutes, she murmurs, her eyes never leaving his. Yes, it's wonderful. I think that passage pretty much summarizes where a literary writer stands. 6 minutes. Yes, it's wonderful.
Joan Frank reading from her book, Late Work, A Literary Autobiography of Love, Loss, and What I Was Reading. She also has recently published a novel called Juniper Street, a reflection on memory, friendship, youth, and loss, set in a Northern California that comes to life. Joan and I don't detail the novel very much, but use it as a springboard for our ranging conversation. If you are a writer listening who perhaps has published a small press book or maybe a university publication, even with some amount of prestige associated with it, it may not change your life in a tangible way. You may still live on the edge and work day jobs or edit other people's work to get by. However, you may also feel the absolute compulsion that drives the likes of any writer, simply to write and keep practicing your art. I welcome you, Joan, to talk about Juniper Street, a novel and late work, a literary autobiography of love, loss, and what I was reading. And an essay in the book of late work is called What Are We Afraid Of? And you talk about qualities of the late work writer, and you state that the late work writer must continue to surprise herself and, quote, allow weird newness and new weirdness. So since you've come out with this novel, Juniper Street, I wonder, what is that newness that you have brought to the material of Juniper Street?
Right. Thank you for that lovely question. And it's an apt one because, and a sort of bittersweet one, because Juniper Street is based upon notes that I kept pretty much suppressed for 30 years of my own experience in that area of Sacramento in the 60s when I was coming of age. There was so much emotional pain affiliated with those memories that every time I tried to work with the notes I had taken, I just found it overwhelming and couldn't cope and put them away again. I would noodle with them between other projects or as an escape from the difficulties of other projects, something I do encourage writers to do. And finally, I figured out that if I broke them down into very small bite sizes, I could handle them long enough to lay them down like a mosaic. And I encourage developing and younger writers to consider this as a method when material threatens to overwhelm or be just scaldingly painful, to break material down into small bits, even a paragraph, and try to get through that and then put it aside, and then try to get through the next one and then put it aside. If you break it down, as in the famous words of Annie Lamott, bird by bird, you can cope with it and eventually find yourself building a whole, which you can then smooth and shape and work with. And I think it's important for writers who ask about methodology and organization of material and working with material to let themselves make a mess, to let themselves be afraid, to let themselves feel stuck, to let themselves not know where in the world they are going, because it's got to somehow, it being the coalescence of material, the clarity of material, the coherence of material, it's got to kind of come up through the writer's body like magma through a volcano. It's got to be itself. It's got to insist on what it needs in its own good time. The best the writer can do, I think, very often, paraphrasing the late, brilliant, iconic Carson McCullers, is to let herself be a vessel for what comes through, for what comes in. In other words, if you can, at any point, keep trying to shovel away performance anxiety and let yourself dwell with whatever it is. And if it's too painful, invent ways and games and tricks to scuttle around it in your efforts to get at it. That's what happened for me with Juniper Street. I never expected anything to happen for it or with it, but I kept noodling and finally found that breaking it down idea. And then I had a series of small chapters, which another interviewer has told me struck her as being like a series of pictures, which I love. I love that so much. A series of pictures is a wonderful description of a novel, because that enters the body differently, I think, than mere words or the memory of strings of words. So when, just on a whim, I entered this novel into a literary competition and it won, I just about dropped my teeth. I couldn't imagine such a thing happening, and it did, and I was thrilled and amazed, and now find myself talking about the fact that it lay dormant for 30 years. And I'm glad that it exists simultaneously with late work, because it is a late work. It's a perfect example of late work.
You know, Joan, for readers of your work, I think they will, as I did, feel your voice almost reading it to me. Now, it is called a novel, and you have expressed that this is maybe shards taken from your own life and experience.
Yes.
And I felt that the narrator in the book, who was an author, was you, and though this is a fiction, and you visit themes here, and there are some episodes which are reminiscent of some of your nonfiction work. And I think in particular of an essay I recall from Try to Get Lost, where you visit the house you grew up in.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yes.
So, I mean, on this meta level, I was feeling your pain and confusion of Joan Frank, the author, kind of sifting through into this work that is all about loss and memory.
Yes, all true, yes. Thank you.
Talk about this a bit.
And so I'm going to say this, that, you know, I know readers struggle to address an author respectfully when they wonder, is this you? Is this your life? An author, I think, is lying to deny it when that is the case. But a simultaneous truth about calling a thing fiction is that it is given a rich, deep, extra dimension. It's given what Edna O'Brien called she's still alive, thank goodness, brilliant novelist Edna O'Brien calls transfiguration. So yes, it's me. Yes, it's my life. But as a novel, as a fiction, it kind of opens out as a dimensional dream in ways it would not in a reader's mind, I believe, if a reader read it as memoir. There's an example I want to give you, which is an iconic, slender little novel that I hold in my heart like pieces of the true cross, by the late William Maxwell, called So Long, See You Tomorrow. So Long, See You Tomorrow. An exquisite jewel of a little work, which pretty much investigates a similar circumstance and setting in the author's nameless, by the way, like my Juniper Street protagonist is nameless, narrator is nameless, in the author's memory. And I'm almost certain that William Maxwell was telling a story that mostly happened to him, that he was part of. The memory was triggered much later when he briefly saw a boy in high school with whom he'd shared this terrible memory involving adultery out in the Midwest, in the forlorn, forsaken prairie, adultery, a murder, a terrible displacement of a family. Tragedy comparable to that which Juniper Street quietly leads up to. And Maxwell told it so purely, so clearly, with at the same time casting so much, how should I say, he talked about memory as an unreliable thing, a kind of shape-shifting thing. And in a way, I tried to sneak some of that into Juniper Street, where I indicate this is what I'm remembering. I'm not sure it's really the concrete deal, but it's the best I can summon. And here's how I feel about it now across these long years. Maxwell conveyed a similar feeling of an adult casting a tender eye on the effortfulness and tragedy of long ago. Friendship and memory. Friendship was a big one in the Maxwell book too. I encourage all your listeners to pick up the Maxwell book, So Long, See You Tomorrow. My husband, who is a very discerning reader, told me that he believes that the way a painter tries to capture light, that I try to capture time. And I have loved that very much. That too is part of my relationship to Juniper Street. Also, in all the stories I tell, in fiction particularly, that I'm compelled by what is felt in retrospect to have been a quality of inevitability about the trajectories of our lives, like music. In other words, if you think of a famous passage of music, say the first four notes of Beethoven, dun, 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 you can't imagine it unbeing, can you? It seems to have existed for all time, like Stonehenge. And that's how I want my fiction to feel, because that's what I most admire in the fiction that enters me to stay, which is really what I believe good fiction does with all of us. It enters us at some cellular level, even if we don't consciously remember it, to stay, and it informs everything we think and everything we do. But best of all, it helps us feel met by human experience that may connect to our own, that may corroborate our own or comfort our own. Fiction has magical properties when it's good. Although, as late work talks about, I have become very discouraged about the destiny of literary fiction in our time. The converse of that discouragement is that I have noticed that we seem to need art every day of our lives, or we begin to feel very, very unwell. And I cling to that as a shipwreck survivor clings to a floating mast. That demonstrates to me every day of my life that you got to have art, you got to have art in all forms, but particularly for me, naturally, in literary fiction. I hope that wasn't too convoluted a riff, Suzanne.
No, you get to riff. I love your riffs, and you get to do it all you want.
Thank you.
There's a lot to unpack there, though. I want to talk a little bit about John Williams. And in fact, you have an essay called What Would John Williams Do?
Oh, yay. I'm so glad you're bringing that up.
And I will say, you quote Lucy Greeley saying, "You have to work hard every day to remember." And it seems like you're...
Yes.
Your telling of Juniper Street is a real testament to that sentiment of...
Oh, I see.
Of remembering.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but yes, it's funny. I was thinking more in terms of you have to work hard every day to remember why in the world one does what one does. You have to refresh your purpose, your relationship to your purpose every day of your life. In my experience, for some odd reason, it's never done and dusted. And doubt creeps in, and you have to confront yourself practically every hour to remember why you do what it is you do, and not be fooled by some more vain or superficial purposes. But thank you, because Juniper Street is, if nothing else, a testament to the power of memory and the essentiality of memory. I think the need for it to make us feel whole and like beings of parts. That is, beings who are more than the given current person you see or hear.
You know, before we get into John Williams, I will observe that within your book of essays, Late Work, it seems like there is this thread that I feel you're expressing to me here right now of you enjoy and are satisfied by being clever, but you don't want to be clever. You
absolutely true.
You don't want to distract with that, and you're always kind of riding this edge of even what does success mean. You don't like being called successful by others, though you have 12 books and many articles, and by many people would say that's a sign of success. But
it's not your metric. And so I think through the running through a lot of these essays is this kind of duality within mm-hmm. yourself. And it gets kind of back to every day you have to remember and maybe even reset what it is that you really are all about.
That's a perfect word and a perfect description, Suzanne. And it's really true. I do ride an edge of, it's a very irritable edge too, of trying to stay true to the purity of the purpose and the utter vulnerability of the purpose versus what happens once the work enters the world where you must hustle and kind of strategize and try to leverage and all the most distasteful human functions to market the stuff. And that's, I wrestle with it all the time, because if you scratch any writer up and down the food chain of writerly famousness, all will express to you some private bitter resentment against not having been properly acknowledged or attributed to. Doris Lessing, when she won the Nobel, apparently sat down on her front stoop in front of all of the paparazzi and had no joy. Instead, she complained, "Where was this prize and where were these judges when I really needed them?" And I know that it sounded churlish probably and unkind, but I thought I really understood, because every writer has an idea of where she should be and what should have happened. And in the essay you allude to called "You've Made It," I tried to respond honestly to a couple of people who looked at me with big loving saucer eyes and said, "Wow, Joan, you've made it." And I loved their admiration, and I loved their wish to praise, and I loved their kindness and their generosity. But I had to try to explain to them that in the world of writing, it's harsh, and making it for me doesn't look like what it seems to look like for them. I'm very proud of my oeuvre. I'm very proud of a body of work, very proud of the small presses who helped usher the books into the world. But what I had wished for was something that may only be possible now, or in the way that I envision it, way back in the 50s, when a writer could get money for her work in advance and then have a contract for more work and then be respectfully reviewed in the major media and then just repeat that pattern ad infinitum to the end of her life. It's not that way now, obviously. It's a shatter belt now. It's balkanized, and the money is rare. So a writer has to be a kind of a lone cowboy and make as many friends as she can and work the crowd as best she can and hope for the best. It's a very complicated and conflicted state of being. One thing that makes it better, besides being aware of that, what I said earlier about needing to eat art every day or you'd start to feel unwell, is singling out other people's work for praise when you love it, which thank God is often. And I, as a reviewer, and this is a thing that I'm proud of, I get to review for the Washington Post and the Boston Globe and sometimes the San Francisco Chronicle. Whenever I am able to pounce on a book that is to me glorious and really work hard to sing its praises eloquently in a review, I feel like I'm putting good into the world of it all, putting good out there and making people aware of a good thing. It just feels wonderful. It feels wonderful. So I try to concentrate on that and not on the dark side that I just described to you. And also on the way authors I've admired, like John Williams, behaved in the face of commercial crassness or importunings to become more commercial. He would have said, "Thank you very much," walked off and continued with the art quest, the art spirit, which in the end is what any believer most admires and which anyone I really admire most admires. It's a kind of, if it's an underground, well, so be it. It'll just stay an underground for the duration. But I don't see that underground going away anytime soon. And I have to remind myself that I'm a card-carrying member. How's that?
Yes, yes. And you are very generous in your work about citing other authors and quoting other authors. And for our readers out there, and for myself, it really opens up a whole perspective that we often don't get by just maybe approaching the bestseller list or...
Or the big gun writers, because they tend not to talk about these things.
Yes. So there's a couple different threads I want to follow here. But since we've mentioned John Williams a couple of times, because it seems like in another one of your books, you talked about Stoner and Williams. And he has been somewhat rediscovered. It seems that if Tom Hanks is involved with anything...
Yeah.
It immediately escalates the work, and maybe you need to get to know Tom Hanks. But Williams, he's also been called, Williams, not Tom Hanks, one of the great unheralded writers. And so it seems like, as we've just been talking about, this is something you grapple through with your own writing life. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about Williams and Stoner and Joan Frank all in the same conversation.
Off the top of my head, Williams emblemizes to me a quality of stoicism. I can't make claims for his personal life or whether he was a particularly likable guy, but as an artist, I see that he just quietly made the work he felt he had to make and pushed on even when commercial response was dismal. And it isn't only Williams who's had that cross to bear. In fact, when Scott Fitzgerald's Gatsby came out, critics kind of sniffed at it. When Melville did Moby Dick, everybody excoriated it. They hated it. And the writer just has to sit in the mud with that, I'm paraphrasing, and figure out what next to do. In other words, there's always this strange and terrible gap between the writer's vision and the product of that vision, and then the mainstream population's response to that vision. And seldom do they coordinate. There seems to be a lapse, a time lapse and an echo lapse where recognition comes later and very, very often, terribly sadly often, posthumously. But what I most admired about Williams's Stoner is that it is a championing of the inner life. And I think that's what any writer who is a writer recognizes instantly in the novel called Stoner. It's a very sad and quiet novel. The ersatz trajectory of it is a very quiet one. A man lives a life in which he discovers the life of the mind rather late. He's from a farm family, a hard-scrabbling farm family. He is galvanized by what he suddenly struck by in a college English class and resolves then and there to teach college literature for the rest of his days. And he does so quietly. His marriage is a disaster for whatever reason. And a colleague in the department where he teaches conspires to destroy him. And the man lives quietly through these things. What saves him is a temporary love affair with someone who understands it all with him. And that's the glorious salvation and the redeeming grace. But then that too must end, and the man must eventually die. Unheralded, unheralded. A wonderful word, by the way, Suzanne. So, and we read this book and we think, what am I supposed to take away? How am I supposed to understand this? And slowly it kind of seeps through you like a slow burn that the man's life was a blaze of truth and dignity under assault, almost Christ-like, and that there was elegance and dignity every step of the trajectory of his life. And that in a way that becomes, if not a metaphor, a kind of emblem or biosample of how I believe we are supposed to take in art and even make art. In other words, you're true to that purest inside spirit of humanness and art making. And that has its own dignity, what a friend of mine calls the dignity of fact. Stoner was a life changer for not just me, but zillions of other writers. And they recognized the sort of precious jewel of it and hold it close. Some people like to make fun of it. Perhaps they think it's over earnest and not going to date well. But I disagree. I think it's a beautiful exemplar of a life of the soul and spirit and mind. And Williams himself, by consequence, is an exemplar for me that way too. So I think of Stoner and I think of William Maxwell particularly, and other titles that are desperately important. The writer Joel Agee wrote a memoir called 12 Years about growing up in the German Democratic Republic. He is the son of the late iconic James Agee. And that too has its incandescence. And you'll notice that I mix memoir and fiction here because they carry that same numinous property of a quest for the marrow of the meaning of human life during our brief time here. Nothing more nor less than that, really. James Baldwin is another. Okay, I hope that didn't wander too far.
Not at all. We could keep wandering.
We could. We totally could.
I think that your work is called by you and others literary fiction, and it is too literary to be commercial or
too cerebral.
That term, though, literary fiction, has often bothered me.
Yes, it is a terribly bothering thing.
Because it's like, well,
what?
Why is that a limitation? But you did just mention it is cerebral, it is emotional, and it can be challenging simply because you, I will say, you do make references, as we're talking about here, to art and literature and music, and you have a very rich language that at times itself can be challenging.
I know that.
But it's also, it seems like, what your complete joy in conversation and in writing resides in the use of language.
Totally.
But let's let our listeners know, well, what is literary fiction, and maybe why we should stop even using that term to describe work like yours?
Right. I despair for anything that will serve as a comparable term. Literary fiction, I don't even remember when it came about as a term, because in the old days, meaning I guess my adolescence and childhood, all fiction was literary. A book was a literary thing. But somehow along the marketing trail, it broke up and fiction came to become a commercial product with looking for wide appeal among the widest population, and therefore became more structured, easier to digest, more satisfying in terms of a predictable arc and denouement, or a closure that was deeply gratifying and fair and just to everybody and made everybody happy, basically. Literary fiction came to mean stories that were difficult, language that was challenging, plots or lacks of plots that were equally challenging. In other words, a workout for the mind and presumably heart. There are early examples, but it wasn't called literary fiction then. One would have been like, said, James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room. Some in the days of my childhood and adolescence made the crossover or sat on the fence between commercial and literary before those designations were made. Hemingway might be one, Fitzgerald might be another, possibly Catherine and Porter. But at that point, you're starting to veer into serious literary, meaning your mind is going to have to work. But that doesn't ignore the heart or the spirit. And I resent the term now. And yet it's the only one that I have to designate a narrow bandwidth of, and I have to use the word quest, because most literary fiction, in my view, for my money, is an investigation. You write into a question, you write into a not knowing, and you write to find out. And that's its gig, that's its thing. It guarantees nothing. And you're along as a reader, as a witness and a co-investigator. And that's part of what's thrilling for my money about it. But others are uncomfortable. My dearest, oldest friend, my high school English teacher, who encouraged me to write from the age of 15 and kept cheering even when I couldn't or wouldn't. And as the books began to come out, I would send them all to him and he would cheer and cheer. and write A plus on his letters back. I finally sent him a last couple of books, and he wrote back. And whenever he could, he would tell friends and students to read my stuff. And only laterally in the last couple of years did he confess, Joan, you know, a lot of people come back to me and said, that stuff is pretty dark. And I felt terrible for him because he was, you know, the egg was on his face for having recommended me. And how could he possibly explain to people, well, that's kind of what literary fiction can do and be. It's not always a basket of roses. So I'm simultaneously proud of and vexed by the designation. And I have to stick with it until something better comes along. But for now, it's kind of economic death, the term literary fiction. It means appealing only to an elite or obscure group, and therefore a risk in terms of publishers. And that's why, God bless them, small publishers are racing into the rescue. They are taking on difficult or darker works, or works that require a bit of work to take in. And they are priding themselves on putting that work in the world. The disadvantage is that they're very small, their resources are few, and they can do very little to promote stuff. But once in a while, something escapes the smallness of that structure and shoots into the stratosphere. An example would be Tinkers by Paul Harding, a beautiful little novel initially put out by Bellevue Literary Press. And that's a press that comes out of the hospital, Bellevue, in the East. Tinkers was about a man with epilepsy remembering his father, who was a tinker. It's utterly, utterly one of the outstanding jewels of the century, even. And of course, it got picked up in one of those serendipitous buzz connections, and a larger publisher bought it, and the rest is history. And Paul Harding, I think, is teaching at Yale or Harvard now. But that's what small presses can do, and I thank heaven for them. All of my work, my entire body of work, issues from small presses. And so let literary fiction ring is the way I would conclude this. Let it ring to the believers, capital B, and let us be an underground and thrive on and go down by the river and recite memorized stuff to each other until the end of time, in the way of what I think that's a Ray Bradbury scene in Fahrenheit 451.
We're visiting today with author Joan Frank on the occasion of her two most recent publications, the novel Juniper Street and her book that Joel Agee calls one of the best books on writing and the writing life I have ever read. Late Work, a literary autobiography of love, loss, and what I was reading. I have been wanting to talk about the author John Williams and his 1965 novel Stoner, which follows the life of a literary professor, William Stoner. This is a book that greatly influenced Joan, and Joan always opens me up to going beyond the familiar. We'll return in a minute to hear the rest of my conversation with Joan Frank. Let's take a short break.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had said, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
I am Suzanne Lang with KRCB's A Novel Idea. That was a 1965 recording of She's Not There from the Zombies. That's part of the soundtrack in Joan Frank's recent novel, Juniper Street. And we've been listening to my conversation with her, and let's return to it.
Well, I also want to point out that you write in this book, Late Work, an essay about the publication of The Outlook for Earthlings, which is a novel that took a long time to find a publishing home, over 15 yes. years.
Yes.
And it is what I'm going to refer our listeners to, the interview that you and I did together that talked about that book and that episode. But it indicates really the methodical steadiness in your life as a writer and seeking to push your work into my realm, into the realm of the reader. But you also, in this book of essays, talk about the loneliness of a writer. You talk about that more than once. And even when you have readers, there's a loneliness about it. So I wonder if you could tell us about that loneliness experienced by you and other writers as well.
I think that loneliness defines and drives the writer, absolutely. And it's a sort of a terrible and unanswerable riddle that there's a famous book of short stories by the late Frank O'Connor called The Lonely Voice. Actually, it's a book about short stories, about what they do and accomplish. It's a wonderful book. It's hard to get hold of now, but I recommend it to any serious writer as a building block, one of the faces on the Mount Rushmore of writing resources. And that phrase, the lonely voice, strikes like a bell, because that in effect is what all good writing distills to. There is an unappeasable, unassuageable, unanswerable loneliness in the writer that cries out in the lonely voice to be heard. And it's never a full and satisfied connection, but it is an effort, and it is the effortfulness that is kind of tragically glorious, because it's a thing that can't not want to happen. It's hard to even describe. Any writer worth anything, you hear that loneliness in the voice of the story or the memoir or the essay. And I guess I hold that understanding close. It's comforting to me. It's as if all of us in the world of making writing understand that loneliness, are somewhat connected by it and comforted by knowing of it, even though it is never cured, so to speak, or mollified very much. It's part of the energy that drives the quest to make work, to tell stories, to tell essays that tell one's experience. It's a deep, deep drive in us. And in the essay about letter writing, it is a deep driver. It's a thing for me that has been a precious ventilation all my days. Even before I declared myself a writer, I was writing long, long single-space letters to unfortunate correspondents everywhere about my experience. It's a way of saying, I am here. Please hear me. Please hear me. Are you there? Do you know? Do you care? And with any luck, the reader sends back that message in her or his own bottle saying, I am here. Yes, I know. Yes, I care. Meet me at the bottom of the volcano and we'll drink some coconut juice. It's a very primal effort, a very primal cry. The French have a term, cri de coeur, cry from the heart. That's what the lonely voice of art is and does. And I absolutely am a card-carrying practitioner. No question about it. It seeps through, it saturates, it irradiates everything I say and everything I do. I guess it's the one consolation, that would be the word, of making art and living with art and eating art. That's why, you know, Franz Liszt, and I include music, I think, as the most essential and primary art, because I think it enters the veins, music, like a drug, instantaneously, and stays in the body for as long as we're listening. But, you know, like that Lucy Greeley saying, we have to work hard to remember every day, you have to listen again to remember. But Franz Liszt has a series of pieces called Consolations, which the word made me think of, which do, in fact, that very thing. It's someone expressing themselves saying, yeah, I hear you. I'm with you. I'm feeling it too. I hope that begins to talk about it a little bit for you.
Also, I or we as the reader, reading is a solitary act and is done alone in the confines of my own head and heart and thoughts. And yet you have absolutely no control over signification that you maybe had put out there in one way, but I, as the reader, filter it through my own experience. But there's yet, I want to say there's this meeting of reader and writer, both maybe coming from that lonely or isolated place, meeting over the narrative, or even just as you were talking about putting phrases together or putting paragraphs together. Sometimes that's what we're doing as the reader as well.
Right. It's true. I've received some lovely letters since these two books came out from readers far away and saying, oh, this both books spoke to me. This is my experience. You seem to be reading my mind. I feel as though, you know, we're having a slumber party and telling each other our secrets. And I couldn't receive a better sustenance for the work floating out there. That's the message coming back in the bottle. It made me very happy to get those letters. And I just fall all over myself thanking people for them. They mean the very world. And any author who doesn't feel that way is crazy or not properly grateful, because it means the world. I wanted also to point out that an author can get in her own way being worried or kvetching about the ordeal of marketing and the lack of commercial or let's say conventional response to work. When you mentioned the outlook for Earthlings, that it took 15 years to find a home, I thought I might read to you the very end of that essay, which is called Ready or Not. When I'm on a radio interview like this one with you, and
yes.
I'm talking about how it took 15 years and everything was hard and woe is me. And then the interviewer, who's a very savvy guy, super savvy guy, blanking on his name right now, I'll come up with it, says at the very end, let me ask you this, Joan. Today, looking back on all your books, what does it make you think? What do you have to say about it? Boom. The question blindsided me, my skull emptied. Then it filled with, swear to heaven, white light. A beat later, I found myself astonished by the words coming from my own mouth. That I've been able to inhabit my calling, I heard my independent mouth say. Hesitantly, I repeated what I'd heard. I've been able to live inside my calling, done it, despite all the day jobs and between and after them, always riding the full tilt, gory carousel of human striving. Making work had shaped and driven and irradiated my days, my years, my being. Wonderment flooded me, tantamount to Pinocchio's as he looks down at his newly fleshed body after a childhood made of wood. My radio host, though I could not see him, his name is Bill Kienauer, I just remembered. He's a lovely man, and he has his own books out there. My radio host must have been glowing. He'd blown his guest speaker's mind. Get back then, inner whiner. The plain, innocent fact of the above newly grasped reality, the blatant revelation of it, always there, had I but stopped long enough to see, name, and embrace it, has been wagging a reminding finger at me ever since. Remember this, my conscience murmurs, every single time you reflect upon that so-called saddest story ever told. And the sad story was the story of getting Earthlings into the world after 15 years of flogging the bushes. So heaven bless you, Bill Kienauer, if you're listening to this, for giving me that little lightsaber of truth and wisdom.
You know, Joan, that was a very satisfying moment.
Thanks. Thank you, my dear.
In reading that, you acknowledged for yourself that this is your calling and you are engaged in it.
Right.
You're not denying it. You're not shunting it off or calling it something else.
Right. And I think, one has to work every day to remember that, but it is worth remembering. Engagement seems, Suzanne, to be the ball game for most of us. And if those of us who can't locate engagements seem to signal so much and so sadly that they are drowning, you know, one wishes engagement for anybody, no matter at what or in what, because that's where we most feel alive, or so it seems. Yeah.
And identify with our own core self, the heart of who we are.
So true.
Joan Frank, Juniper Street, a novel, late work, a literary autobiography of love, loss, and what I was reading. And you just used the term engagement, and I was ultimately engaged in your dishing and your forgiving yourself for dishing, your honesty.
Thank you.
You talk about that, about telling the truth and not being afraid. In fact, I think one of the chapters is called something like, what are we afraid of? Or what are you afraid of?
And
honesty and telling it like it is always been something that has been the hallmark of your writing, in my mind.
Thank you, Suzanne. And may I add that you are sublime at your art of interviewing and delving so deeply into the works of people you speak with, really, really engaging with the hearts of those works. When I think of that kind of engagement, I think of a hands held with all the fingers intertwined, fiercely embracing. It's an honor. It's an honor.
I thank you. I feel likewise. And I have to say that towards you and a lot of what you wrote through some of these essays, I related to quite a bit as my own role as somebody trying to bring forth information and heart and exposing listeners to what they might engage with. So I related to quite a bit of it. And I thank you so much for these books, Joan, and for talking to me today.
Suzanne, thank you with all my heart. I look forward, heaven bless us, to the next time.
My conversation with Joan Frank. Joan considers herself a late writer, a late career writer, and she has had an amazing run of recent publications, and we hope there is more to follow. And you are welcome to hear my previous conversations with her. We stream and podcast at krcb.org. We're on NPR Podcasts and iTunes as well. Thank you, Joan Frank. I am grateful to Will Penny and Mark Prell at KRCB. We opened the show with Julian Bream's Majorca, Opus 202 from 1975, and Joan Baez closes out the show with A Girl of Constant Sorrow from 1960. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.
I am a girl of constant sorrow. Have seen troubles all my days. I'm going back to California, place where I was partly raised. All through this world I'm bound to ramble, through sun and wind. Western Red.